Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. Now, probably going back a couple of years now, I did a podcast on the beginnings of the Communist Party of Great Britain in 1920 and the involvement of the Soviet Union, involvement of the Bolsheviks in its creation and the involvement of Soviet funding in the establishment of the Communist Party. Today, after a long, long wait, I'm returning to the topic and looking at how Lenin conceived of shaping the Communist Party of Great Britain. I'm looking at Francis Beckett's really excellent history of the Communist Party, The Enemy Within. And Francis Beckett writes really, really eloquently about Lenin's involvement. He writes, "Lenin wanted the Communist Party of Great Britain run his way. To achieve this, the Comintern brought together the two men who came to dominate the party for most of its life, Harry Pollitt and Rajani Palmdutt. Comintern instructions for Communist parties, drawn up in 1921, demanded democratic centralism. Parties must be run from the centre. Party leaders must be able to take decisions which bind all members. So communist parties must have iron discipline, and all Comintern decisions must be binding on all communist parties. A three-man commission was set up to translate this into practice for Britain. In addition to Pollitt and Dutt, there were Harry Inkpen, the brother of Party Secretary Albert Inkpen, but he also seems to have little influence." So the term democratic centralism needs to be kind of drilled down into. And it was a device created by Lenin during the Russian Civil War, which gave Lenin ever greater levels of dictatorial control over the Bolshevik Party, or the Communist Party, as it became. During the Russian Revolution, obviously there were waves of democratization during 1917, the creation of Soviets, of workplace committees in army regiments and in factories, which were represented by the Petrograd Soviet, then above that the All-Russian Federation of Soviets. And the brief kind of window of democratization didn't last in the conditions of the Russian Civil War. Firstly, for levels of practicality, you simply cannot have factory committees deciding what needs to be produced and what their working conditions when the White Armies are marching on Moscow. Secondly, it was always Lenin's intention to extend personal control over the party and therefore over the levers of state in the manner in which he did. Democratic centralism really meant autocratic decision making. In practice, democratic centralism worked when the Politburo would vote in majority terms on a particular issue, so perhaps 60% in favour of something. What that would result in would be the closing down of debate on the subject. So if the Politburo voted 60% in favour of, say, the new economic policy, then the decision was taken and it was binding and all party members were meant to follow it. Anything other than that would be considered factionalism. So as you get in all democratic parties, there are debates that never quite go to bed. There are within democratic parties such as the Labour Party in Great Britain or perhaps slightly less democratic parties such as the Republican Party or the Conservative Party, there are, you know, factions and schisms and splits and things that are never quite resolved. The Leninist way of looking at this increasingly in 1921 was that factionalism should be banned. The idea of what factionalism was, you know, people discussing different policy issues, perhaps on their own, perhaps in each other's offices or apartments, and having different views away from Lenin. Lenin, increasingly paranoid, perhaps as the result of his various strokes, saw this by 1921 as grounds for removal from the party. In his book in 1902, What Is To Be Done, he laid out the kind of the rough ideas of democratic centralism and said, essentially, you need this kind of decision-making structure in a revolutionary party. Otherwise, it becomes just a talking shop where nothing happens. It becomes a bland committee and it's easily infiltrated by the secret police. And so you can wind up with all sorts of kind of saboteurs and troublemakers bringing endless debate and or injecting contrary opinions into the party. So you need some kind of rather ruthless sort of determination in order to make sure that that doesn't happen. Now, the way in which democratic centralism worked in foreign communist parties was that ideas and edicts and policies and intellectual positions came from Moscow. Parties must be run from the centre, and party leaders surely must needed to make decisions and have iron discipline. But Comintern decisions, decided in Moscow, were binding on all communist parties. So it was a way, democratic centralism was a way of making a communist party in Spain, in Italy, in France, Britain, Germany or America, a localised outpost of Leninist doctrine in Moscow. It was the Communist Party would be the overt, the kind of the surface level agent of Moscow, Moscow's policies in a foreign country, whereas espionage, illegal espionage, run from the embassy would later become the kind of the hidden below the surface aspect of Comintern activity. So a little on Harry Pollitt. Harry Pollitt was born in 1890 in Ashton-under-Lyme, in Droylsden, in point of fact. It's a northern industrial town in the kind of the cotton country of the textiles country of Greater Man, now Greater Manchester. The son of a working class family, his mother, like many working class women at the time, had lost many children in infancy through kind of poverty and exhaustion. And he wrote in his memoirs that she had kind of left for work at 4:30 a.m. Every day. Lived in, and the family grew up in penury. So the kind of biography that one would expect from the kind of the working class communist left, the those who had really experienced the hardships and sufferings of industrial life. His mother had been one of the founder members of the Independent Labour Party, and had also joined the Communist Party when it was founded in 1920. Francis Beckett writes, "When he was 27, in November 1917, he read about the event which shaped the rest of his life. The Russian Revolution brought the Bolsheviks to power, and Pollitt saw that workers like me and all those around me had won power, had defeated the boss class. By then, he was a skilled craftsman, a boilermaker, an experienced strike leader, a member of Sylvia Pankhurst's Workers' Socialist Federation, an effective public speaker, and the proud owner of a copy of Marx's Capital, given to him by his mother on his 21st birthday. Sylvia Pankhurst brought money from Moscow's Hands Off Russia campaign, instigated and funded by Lenin, and involving most of the future leaders of Britain's Communist Party. Pollitt became its full-time organiser, but became restless in a desk job and went back to work in the Port of London. There he helped persuade dockers to refuse to fill the SS Jolly George with coal because the ship was loaded with munitions intended to help Poland fight Russia." The Jolly George incident is a really kind of telling part of Britain's experience at the height of the Russian Revolution. The Jolly George, as it says there, was a munitions ship on the way to Poland. And when dock workers decided that they were unwilling to load it and unwilling to send munitions to Poland in 1920, which happened to be the year that the Poles crushed the Red Army at the gates of Warsaw, it gave further kind of cause to the suspicions of Britain's ruling classes that a revolution was potentially afoot in Great Britain. The decision not to invite the Tsar of Russia, Nicholas II, to live in exile in Britain, by George V, which was partly responsible for the later execution of the Tsar in 1918, was seen as, by this point, quite an astute move, as it was feared that there would be a possible revolution in Britain in favour of the workers' state in the Soviet Union, or in revolutionary Russia anyway, as it would have been known then. I don't believe for a moment that there was an organised, radicalised and revolutionary workers' movement in Britain between 1918 and 1920. There were some workers who were persuaded to strike. There were incidents like the raising of the red flag over George Square in Glasgow. But by and large, these were localised, isolated incidents. And the communist movement, or the socialist movement in Britain, was no way near strong enough, established enough. And the countries where there had been revolutions, a democratic revolution in the Kaiser's Germany in 1918, and obviously the two revolutions in Russia in 1917, these are countries that had effectively lost wars. They had dealt with the calamities and disasters on a far greater magnitude than Great Britain had during the First World War. Their societies had not been, or Britain, the British society had not been sufficiently smashed open in order for there to.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
To be those kinds of revolutionary tensions. It's not to suggest that Britain between 1918 and 1920 had a harmonious society, not one bit of it. It was a society stricken with economic and social crisis and conflict, but nothing on the scale that would have been required really to overthrow the British state. In 1921, Harry Pollitt went to Moscow for the first time and met Lenin. He was paid to go by the Red International of Labour Unions, of which he was part of the British Bureau of. And the time that he shook Lenin's hand and met Lenin face to face was kind of indelibly printed upon him for the rest of his life. He said, "This was a handshake that meant everything in the world to me." He was a delegate at the Labour Party conference as a member of the Boilermakers Union that year. And there are some curious tensions between the Labour Party and the Communist Party of Great Britain during the 1920s and 1930s. To the Labour Party, the Communist Party was a pariah organisation. The Labour Party boycotted support for the hunger marches of the 1930s, partly because the Communist Party was involved in their organisation. Vice versa, the Communist Party looked upon the Labour Party as being worse than the Conservatives, worse than the Liberals, because the point of the Labour Party in the eyes of the Communist Party was to stave off revolution. They saw it as a counter-revolutionary organisation. It was there to make a gradual and piecemeal change in the lives of the working classes to prevent the necessity for revolution. And so it was a kind of like a part of the system, one of the kind of the more insidious and clever parts of the system. To some extent, there's perhaps some justification in that point of view. But I doubt very much whether it is even as conspiratorial as that. At the conference, Harry Pollitt said that he described the Communist Party as an integral part of the English working class movement. And when you imagine that nearly everything that Marx wrote was written in Great Britain in the British Library, and that Marx drew from the cooperative movement, socialists like Robert Owen. He drew from previous revolutionary traditions of the early 19th century, the kind of the Blanketeers and the Luddites and all these sorts of people who protested against the iniquities and the the poverty of the era. And Marx even looked back at the diggers and the Chartists, and before that the diggers and the levellers, and believed that he could see a kind of a revolutionary tradition in England. So Marx and English socialism have a long and complex relationship with one another. So what Pollitt was saying wasn't entirely untrue. And he said that Labour in government will not depend on the Fabian Society for their power. They will depend on the men in the mine, the mill and the shipyard. That's where the bulk of the Communist Party happens to be. By that he meant that the Fabian Society were the progressive socialists, or perhaps many of them didn't even consider themselves to be socialists, but the kind of progressive figures are on the left, who were largely middle class, largely intellectual, the likes of Beatrice Webb and George Bernard Shaw, who viewed a progressive move towards a gradually more civilised version of capitalism as being the end goal of the Labour Party, even though one of the chief members of the Fabian Society, Sidney Webb, drew up the Labour Party constitution and drew up and added clause 4 to it, which is essentially about the common ownership of the means of production, though a kind of a heavily watered down version of that. And so Pollitt was saying basically that the Communist Party happened to be heavily embedded in working class organisations, heavily embedded in the mines and the shipyards and those sorts of places. And that's where the Labour Party would traditionally look for its support. How much that was realistic, it would remain to be seen. The other person to talk about is, of course, Palm Dutt. Palm Dutt was the son of an Indian doctor and a Swedish writer, who'd grown up in the 1890s and the 1900s in a relatively impoverished circumstances in Cambridge. In 1916, under the age of 20, he insisted on his right to go to prison and refused the draft. He appealed, and his appeal was successful, and he was conscripted, but refused again and spent 6 months in prison. This was a very difficult time for him. It broke his health. And he, I think, as a non-white British man refusing to fight for king and country, had an exceptionally tough time at the hands of the prison guards. He was expelled from Oxford University, where he studied, for organising a meeting in support of the Russian Revolution. This was after he was freed in 1917. But he came back in, took his finals, and got a first-class degree. He was a passionate communist, and Francis Beckett writes, he explained why 50 years later he had been so devout in his communist views by recalling an international student meeting that he attended in Geneva with the communist Ellen Wilkinson, who would soon leave to join the Labour Party and became cabinet minister in the 1945 Labour government. He said, as so often in international conference, there arose an English problem. In this case, whether to accept us in the proposed International Organisation of Socialist Students or not. Accordingly, that night, a faction meeting was called of the communist representatives to decide what to do with the English. We were allowed to be present as silent spectators. The discussion was held in an attic and continued into the small hours. At one point, the police arrived in the house. We adjourned through the attic window into a neighbouring attic and the discussion continued. Our organisation and line was analysed relentlessly, like a body being dissected on a mortuary slab. At the end, the decision went against us. As we came away in the cold hour of the December night, Ellen Wilkinson said to me, "This is ghastly, callous, inhuman. This is the most ghastly, callous, inhuman machine I've ever witnessed." I said to her, "At last I have found what I've been looking for. Socialists who mean business." So there's a fascinating little anecdote about the admiration that Dutt had for the kind of ruthlessly deterministic bureaucratism that Leninism would entail. And even though the decision had gone against admitting the English, there was it was the kind of the steeliness of it that he saw as being particularly attractive. The solemn student deliberations were the real stuff of life, Dutt thought. The meaning business meant to him rigorously and faithfully interpreting the party line laid down centrally. So that centralism was something that he admired and something that later he would ensure was faithfully sort of stamped into the Communist Party of Great Britain. So I'm quite keen to talk more about the Communist Party of Great Britain, not because it was one of the communist parties that particularly shaped the 20th century. Far from it. It was a kind of a minor thorn in the side of the democratic left throughout the 20s, 30s, 40s, and throughout the Cold War period. And there are some kind of interesting contortions that happened during the Second World War. But I think it's interesting to talk about, because when there are institutions, political parties in the democratic world which are sympathetic towards parties or have kind of an alma mater kind of party in a country like the Soviet Union, where that commits all sorts of crimes against its population, the ability to justify this, to accept it, to see this as see the kind of the violent as the progressive, to be blind to certain things, to accept, ameliorate, or see the long term benefit in other things, is kind of darkly fascinating, and it shows how far it shows the power really of ideology. As a kind of a secular religion, giving people who have banked on an imagined utopia coming at some undisclosed point in the future, the right to support very often the indefensible. Anyway, thanks very much for this. Now, just a quick note, I'm keeping an eye now on examinations, whether they are going ahead or not in the current coronavirus crisis. If they are, I will do my very best on the Patreon page to provide as many free resources to students as possible. If you can afford to sponsor the page, then that's great, and that helps people that haven't got the income or the resources to find, say, private tuition in a time when schools are going to be closed, to access some good quality material, and hopefully it will help them with exams. If you can't afford to make a donation, please don't worry about it. Just let everybody else know that should there be exams pending and no teachers to teach A-level GCSE history, there helps on the way in some small capacity. Anyway, thanks very much for listening, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. All the best. Bye-bye.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.